So, continuing to talk about Zazen, last week we talked about posture mostly, and I want to say, I meant to say it before we started, but at any rate, the latest iteration of our experiment with the Saturday morning schedule is we're going to go now until 11:15 and include some question and answer time here. And then, we can go on talking about whatever we like during tea. So, it's the body, it's posture, it's form. Speaking of form, I'm going to digress again. It's fascinating to me. I just dropped my teaching stick as I was doing my bows. It practically flew out of my hand. And right before that, I had been thinking about a friend of mine who shall remain nameless. When you bow, when you have the stick in your hand, as you bow, you turn it. It's turning. It's the curve is facing out. And as you bow, you turn it so it's facing up. And Hoetsu Suzuki Roshi says that that is because if you had it facing down, it's like the Dharma is leaking out of it, so you hold it this way. And my friend, he doesn't turn it. Whoops. This person doesn't turn it because they just think it's too sort of precious or something like that. And I was thinking, oh, they don't really understand. I wonder if they know about what Hoetsu said. They don't understand. And just as I was criticizing somebody, it flew out of my hand. And I thought, oh, yes, just bow. Just bow. My friend Blanche Hartman called that instant karma. And I'll tell that story and then I'll go on. Hers was that they were, this was early days of San Francisco Zen Center in the city, and the way it was, the teacher was up on a little bit of a raised platform, and then everybody else was sitting on the floor in front of him. And she had recently begun studying tea, and so she really knew how to do the eating stuff and how to hold her utensils and so on. And he made some announcement about how people were eating, like to be more quiet with their spoons or whatever, something like that. And she's holding her bowl in her hand and eating her cereal. And the thought arose, I wonder if he notices how nice I'm doing it. At which point, her bowl leapt out of her hand and rolled across the floor. She called that instant karma, so, oh well. So, body, yes. Mind, no. So what do we do with the mind when we sit zazen? So you put great effort into, you know, sitting up really straight and honoring the curve in your lower back and the back of your neck and relaxing your body, letting go of the tension in your body. You know where your breath is. You've taken a couple of deep breaths and your breath has really settled lower in your body. You've rocked your body right and left and settled into a steady, immobile sitting position. And the next instruction from Dogen in his fascicle on Zazen, the next instruction is, think not thinking. How do you think not thinking? Non-thinking. Non-thinking. What is that? Think not thinking. It doesn't stop this thinking. And there's no point in getting bothered about it. And drop it. Stop it. Let it go. But stop it in the sense of don't get on the train of thought. Not stop it in the sense of block it out or push it away or get angry about it or insist that your brain stop. Let it go. Let it go. Let go of the stories. If there's sadness, cry. Let go of the story. Just crying. If it's helpful, you could say that to yourself. Just crying. Just anger. Just lust. That's not so easy to say. I suppose you could say just thinking. Just rehashing an old fight. So one of the six perfections of a bodhisattva is virya, is energy. And there should be energy in our sitting. And it's the energy that flows naturally, that flows like a fountain. Think of it as this energy goes up and then flows back down. This energy that flows like a fountain, if you will allow it. Too often we block it or we seek to control it. And we tell ourselves stories about it. And particularly if they come from your head. It's just another story. It's just another idea. I think that's the hardest thing to learn, is letting go of this kind of stuff. And it is stuff. And I don't mean to say, I am not saying that you should repress or suppress emotions or ideas. I am saying that Zazen is not the time to think about them. If an emotion arises, let it arise. As we know, things arise, abide, and pass away, but you have to let them arise. And if you don't, they'll come back. They'll bite you or bite other people. And you don't have to get entangled with them. Or maybe I should say, you have to not get entangled with them. And of course, you will get entangled with them. And then you have to let them go. Over and over and over again sometimes. There's periods of Zazen where it feels like it's just letting it go. Here it comes, letting it go, letting it go. That's practice. That's practice. We talk about emptiness. It comes out, it all comes out of, which is not quite right, but you have to talk about it somehow. It comes out of emptiness. The thing is doctrinally, it is emptiness, but you know, your emotion comes out of causes and conditions. Who knows where it comes from? You know, there's an immediate cause and then there's 50 million other things. you don't need to know. Just be jealousy, just be sadness, just be anger. Not even, just anger. Well, let's not even say be it. And let go of the story. And that's one of the hardest things. I remember sitting early on 3 days with Jo Kobeck down in San Diego, and she was a very tough teacher. And see, when I you saw her every day in a private Dokusan interview. And like, especially every time I opened my mouth when I was with her, she'd say, "That's just another idea. That's just another idea." And it was hard. And I was driving home by driving up Highway 5, somewhere around Bakersfield, if this means anything to you, about 100 miles north of LA. And just this overwhelming sense came to me. I'd say it's a thought. It is a thought, but it just, you know, it was one of those ones that comes from the gut, which I tend to trust more. And it was just, but Joko, that's all I have. And I wrote about it when I got home. So I actually know that. And her response was, "Give up hope," which is pretty hard, pretty tough, you know. But that is one of her teachings. Hope is one of those wiggly words that there are times when it's appropriate, but often we. Hope, she's using it in the sense of, you know, grasping after something and wanting a particular result or something like that. And I'm not even sure what I meant, not all of it. But I think a lot of it was something like, you know, my emotions and my talk about it and my ideas, that's who I am. So if I let go of that, then what? What am I? Am I? I think, you know, it felt like that. It was, what do you call it? It was an existential crisis on the freeway and Highway 5.
Bakersfield.
Yeah, right. It was nighttime. That it is that important to learn to let go of all that. Zazen, with the posture, with the effort, is expressing that emptiness, that not having own being, not being permanent. Interconnectedness and no thingness. Zazen is that. And I do think that we must, in order to do Zazen, you need to make that effort. I'll soften it a tiny bit. And you don't have to do this at all, but it's the way that I know to end suffering. It's the way that I know to loosen my grip on my ideas of who I am. There's a wonderful book by Uchiyama Roshi called Opening the Hand of Thought. And I didn't understand quite what he meant for a long time. And then it's quite simple, actually, and straightforward. And I just hadn't read like the introduction or something. He's using it like that we are grasping. We're grasping our ideas of who we are, and our ideas in general, we're always holding on to them. So if we could open that hand of thought, that's liberation. And Zazen is our time to do that. It's our practice time. So that nothing, just do it, actually. And I'm still going to say, so that you can take it out into the world and do less harm and find joy. Because there is a joy in it. There's a joy in that letting go, even when it's difficult. And there was when I had that exchange with Choco Beck on Highway 5, I think I burst into tears. I don't know about joy right at the moment. I don't know. This is too long ago. It's 1990. So, I don't know. But what I'm hesitating about saying, because so, you know, you have the experience, and then afterwards you think about it, right? I wasn't thinking about it. You know, I don't know that I would call it an enlightenment experience, but I would call it a great insight that sort of erupted. And I don't know. There might have been relief afterwards. I don't know about joy. I don't want to oversell it. Zazen is a chance to relax the mind. And as we develop the habit of letting go of discursive thinking, it gets easier. And there is a quieting of the mind. There is a relaxation of the mind. But just as I think I mentioned last week, that sometimes, you know, you have to work at sitting up straight, and it might feel kind of odd, like you're really pushing in with the lower back, or you're reaching up, you know, and you're straining to hold this position, and it feels uncomfortable. But then if you keep doing it, after a while it becomes a habit and it becomes very comfortable. And often backaches go away, things like that. And the same with letting go of discursive thinking. It may be a huge effort, and then it gets easier. Except for time and again when it's not. I mean, if you're really in the middle of a big fight with your spouse or your boss or your employee or whatever, you know, there are just times when it's hard. It's just hard. But even then, you know what it feels like to let go of it, and that encourages you to keep doing it. So do you have any questions or comments or thoughts of your own? Yes?
So I think about non-thinking, I'm not going to say all the time, but sometimes when I'm sitting, and when I first started sitting here, the streets were noisier. Hmm. Have you noticed that? Like there's fewer guys with boom box cars driving by and stuff. And it's much quieter. But back then it was noisier. And I found my intention was to hear the noise, the distraction, but not listen to it. And I kind of think about that with non-thinking too. It's like there's thoughts, but don't pay attention to them. Mm-hmm. You know, like I'm as an insomniac or semi-insomniac, I wake up in the middle of the night and pretty soon, and I can tell the difference between there's just sort of thoughts happening versus I'm having a conversation with myself. Mm-hmm. And so maybe it's sort of like that.
Mm-hmm. I think it is sort of like that.
It's there, but you're not engaged.
Right. Well, yeah. I mean, Uchiyama says that thoughts are brain secretions. You know, it just happens. You know, your stomach is squirting digestive whatever enzymes in, and your heart is pumping and whatever. That just happens. And your brain thinks that you don't have to get entangled.
I sometimes think having the sore back or the knees that ache is part of keeping you present.
Yeah.
That's kind of like a cruel gift.
Right. I told you one story of my friend Pam, when we used to sit at Green Gulch, and we were talking about Sasheen once, and she apparently had... She's one of the people, she has a lot of pain at the beginning of a sesshin, and then after about the second day into the third day, it either resolves somewhat or she just gets used to it. And she was saying, you know, it's really hard, and then all of a sudden she sort of perks up and she says, keeps you present, doesn't it? And I'm not advocating that you torture yourself, but there are times when you should just sit still. And I think I said last night, that's not the place to start because you can hurt yourself. I think she just had a back. She had a back. Anybody else?
Mm-hmm. When a long time ago, a person who practices a different form of Buddhism and I were having this talk, and he said, when you first start practicing Buddhism, it's like either a fire hose or a hose that's been sitting around not being used, and the water comes out, and then all the stuff that comes out is like really yucky water. And that's your karma that's been sitting in there. And when you talked about the fountain, like you're sitting there with a fountain, it occurred to me that maybe that is kind of the difference between early practice and later practice. I'm not sure if it's exactly karma, but that if I remember early on, I feel like I wanted to justify myself a lot more and spend a lot of time in Zazen justifying myself. I don't really want to sit. Why should I have to sit? Well, I decided to sit. Or even something else, like I was really selfish. Yeah, but the person provoked me. You know, like, and then, like, the difference is maybe the less junk is the less justifying. Mm-hmm. I still start a lot of the same conversations, but then they don't always end. You know, I kind of just let, you know, the first thing come and kind of observe it when I can.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because the karma goes on and on and on. That's the only trouble with his, what is that, a metaphor or something?
Right.
But yeah, I mean, it's a common experience that people start sitting and then they come to the teacher or to a friend and they say, I've just become this terrible person. But it's just that they actually are starting to notice, you know, the little selfish things or the little unkind things that we do all the time to ourselves more than anybody and to other people. It's not that you become a terrible person. You just start noticing and it's, you know, it's not always pleasant. Yeah?
Yeah, I think that's because I hear that time and time and time again, probably hundreds of times from people. Mm-hmm. I want to meditate, but I can't meditate because I can't even sit still for 5 minutes because I can't stop thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, I mean, the first session today was pretty good. Did give the second session. I only dictated a letter in my head and thought, I better talk about this letter before I send it out with Mary at the next Dokusan. Other than that, it was okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, oh, anybody else? Yeah.
Can you tell me what karma is?
Okay. You got an hour. The, you know, the common understanding of it, which is not mine, but is that it's sort of a tit for tat. So it's I do X and then Y happens, and that I get sick, it's because I did something mean to somebody in a former life, or I don't know what all. And I think it's much more complicated than that. There are causes and conditions. If I take an action of body, speech, or mind, I mean, including thoughts, there are consequences of it. But they don't necessarily appear or reflect right this second. And I'm constantly... I'm the product, right, the second, we all are, of infinite causes and conditions throughout time and space. And sometimes, like with me throwing my stick, the consequences are immediate and obvious. But sometimes they're not. The karma is that law. Or that it's kind of the way things are. It's that energy that comes out of I don't know if this is going to make sense to you, out of the impulse to act or to react to whatever comes to us. So often the response is a reactive, self-protective one, and there's just this energy boiling all the time of the causes and conditions that have arisen out of innumerable causes and conditions, and our freedom is in how we respond to them as they appear to us, and the more we can open the hand of thought, the more we can simply respond without self-interest or self-regard, then we can kind of lighten that burden. So, yes, that's a, somewhat of an explanation. You know, I guess, you know, we think I have karma. I mean, I am the product of lots of causes and conditions, and some of them are of my own making, and some of them are of my family's making, and my parents' making, and my sister's making, and so on. And my society's making. And some of them are so, I don't know, Buddha was born, that's part of my karma, thank you, thank you. I mean, we don't even know if he existed, but somebody was born and had these teachings. So I think they sometimes talk about the law of karma, which is that the simplest way, Buddha said at one point, he said, this is this way because that's that way. That doesn't get you super far. Thich Nhat Hanh, I think, talked about it as it. There's a child prostitute in Manila because there's a banker in Switzerland. And I think that's a little easier to understand. Is that useful? Okay. What did you have?
I was anticipating closure.
Oh, okay. Ah. We have karma. Yes.
Yeah, when you were talking just now, it occurred to me that maybe another way to work with karma is maybe as opposed to like understanding karma, but a way to work with it is if I start noticing that I can't arbitrarily separate myself from other things, like if I start noticing that when I meant to hurt somebody else, it actually hurts me. Maybe that's part of the practicing with it and realizing it. Or just various ways that I realize that I try to say I'm exempt from something or other in the world, and then I notice in my body that I'm not exempt. Maybe that's like working with it.
Well, it's certainly working with a form of grasping, you know, that, trying to deny emptiness, interconnectedness. So yes, it resonates with me in the sense that I understand what you're talking about, but I don't know if I would talk about karma in those terms. But we could go on and talk about this at tea. I think it's time to stop. Is that okay?
Beings are numberless. I